Today is Thursday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump's impeachment inquiry went public Wednesday. Today, we take a closer look at the testimony and look ahead to Friday's second round of hearings.
Impeachment is a political process. The Constitution puts it in the political branch. So it's important that if the House is going to impeach and the Senate convict or not, that the public be behind them.
Plus, Israel has announced a ceasefire with the Islamic Jihad militant group, but hours later, more rockets were fired. Those stories and more next. Wednesday, the public hearings began in the U.S. House of Representatives as it started its next phase in the impeachment inquiry of U.S. President Donald Trump. It's only the fourth time in the country's history that Congress has undertaken such an endeavor. Democrats called two key State Department witnesses to begin making the case to the American people that Trump abused the power of his office by allegedly pressuring Ukraine to provide information that would help him politically in the 2020 presidential election. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson starts us off with a recap of the first day of hearings and the Republican response from Capitol Hill.
Two U.S. diplomats testifying in public for the first time on allegations President Trump delegated U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine to his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to advance his personal political interests.
I found a confusing and unusual arrangement for making U.S. policy toward Ukraine. There appeared to be two channels of U.S. policymaking and implementation, one regular and one highly irregular.
Taylor and George Kent, a senior State Department official in charge of Ukraine, told House lawmakers Trump cared more about Ukraine's help with investigations into political rival Joe Biden and his son than in releasing $400 million in congressionally approved military aid to Ukraine.
The questions presented by this impeachment inquiry are whether President Trump sought to exploit that ally's vulnerability and invite Ukraine's interference in our elections. Whether President Trump sought to condition official acts, such as a White House meeting or U.S. military assistance, on Ukraine's willingness to assist with two political investigations that would help his reelection campaign. And if President Trump did either, whether such an abuse of his power is compatible with the office of the presidency.
The president downplayed their importance.
There's nothing there. I see they're using lawyers that are television lawyers.
Trump was referring to the Democratic legal counsel who handled some of the witness questioning.
In your decades of military service and diplomatic service representing the United States around the world, have you ever seen another example of foreign aid conditioned on the personal or political interests of the President of the United States?
No, Mr. Goldman, I've not.
Republicans also used a lawyer to question witnesses. But the Republican argument against impeachment was summed up by Trump's chief congressional ally.
President Zelensky had to commit to an investigation of Biden's before the aid got released, and the aid got released and he didn't commit to an investigation.
Mr. I was not wrong about what I told you, which is what I heard. That's all I've said. I've told you what I heard.
And that's the point. What you heard did not happen. It didn't happen.
The support of the American people, who in public opinion polls have increasingly favored Trump's impeachment, is exactly what Democrats hope to win over by holding these public hearings. The committee will hold public hearings with nine more witnesses through the end of next week. The U.S. House of Representatives is expected to hold a full floor vote on articles of impeachment by the end of the year, a move that would trigger a trial of President Trump in the U.S. Senate to decide whether he should be removed from office. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And now to take a closer look at Wednesday's testimony and what it means for both sides of the aisle, we're joined on the phone by Craig Albert, political science professor at Augusta University. Craig, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
So I wanted to start things off here. I mean, this was a monolithic televised hearing yesterday in the House of Representatives. A lot of people here in Washington, of course, were glued to it. Your political science professor, I wanted to get your take on what you thought of yesterday's testimony.
I didn't think it gave us any real new information. So objectively speaking, or from a political science standpoint, I'm not sure that it was as big a deal as everybody made it out to be. So far, we just heard some restatements of facts, some restatement of opinions, not too much new learned from that. The one piece of information that we did learn was one of those testifying saying that one of his staffers had heard a conversation that might allow us to understand more of what President Trump was doing. But that necessarily in and of itself wasn't that important. When that staffer, him or herself, speaks, which I believe will happen this weekend, that may be more important than what we saw yesterday.
If we take a look at the line of questioning, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side, what do you make out of what we saw? Because the Democrats came forward, they launched this inquiry, they are putting that president abused the office for personal gain, and the Republicans have over time shifted their defense. So as this is playing out on television, what are the risks and benefits for both parties?
Well, again, it's my professional opinion that both sides are using this for their electoral policies and campaigns. So the Democrats are trying to demonstrate that President Trump, if not abusing power in a constitutional framework, that he's at least so doing in such a way where he can't be reelected or shouldn't be reelected. And so this is serving as an electoral process where you can kind of judge what he's done and say, well, maybe if it's not impeachable, we certainly shouldn't reelect him on this platform that he's, so not necessarily going to what established practices and policies and the behaviors of a president ought to be. For the Republicans, this is great for their electoral strategy as well, which is, again, in my professional opinion, what I think this process is really about. They're trying to show that from day one, the Democrats have wanted to impeach Trump, and therefore Trump should be reelected because they have not worked towards helping President Trump implement his policies and therefore have hurt and hindered the policies of the United States of America. That's my professional political science take on this so far.
Now, if we take a look at this process, I mean, this is a political process. It's the political remedy outlined in the Constitution. And if you look at the polls across the United States among voting age people and people who are registered, the vast majority of Democrats, over 80% in most of the polls, favor impeachment and or removal. The independents are in the middle ground, while Republicans are in the low teens to mid-teens, maybe 20% maximum. As we move into the 2020 election cycle, not only the House, but the third of the Senate that's up for re-election and the presidential election in 2020, does this airing of the evidence in the House and then later in the Senate, if there is an actual impeachment voted upon and approved in the House, does it become more about addressing those independent voters and getting them on board to tip the tails scales so that Republicans would then be more inclined to vote for impeachment or go along with public sentiment in their own personal election races?
Absolutely. I think the main target audience for this are those independents and then what we want to call the first-time voters that voted in 2016. So for Republicans, the first-time voters in 2016 that voted for Trump are non-typical voters. They don't usually come out. They don't think their vote is important. They're full-time working-class individuals that just think politics isn't important. But candidate Trump at that time spoke to them in a way that made them go out to the polls and vote for him. He thinks that this impeachment inquiry will reinvigorate those individuals and independents as well that voted for him for the first time in 2016 or that voted Republican for the first time in 2016, that they were straying away from President Trump during the first 2 years of office, but now that this is reinvigorating them and it might bring them back to his side. So he's trying to capitalize on that. But the same thing for the inquiry process so far, it is very partisan, and that's disheartening as a political scientist to see on both sides they aren't taking this as an objective, fact-finding inquiry, but both trying to gain political points and using it toward the electoral process, which I think is extra constitutional in their duties, meaning that this is something that they're doing that might not necessarily be within the scope of what the founding framers wanted.
In about 30 seconds, that's all the time we have left. Moving forward, we have hearings scheduled Friday with Maria Yovanovitch and then several next week. Do you anticipate any change in strategy on either the parts of the Democrats or the Republicans based on this first outing?
I don't think the Republicans will change much strategy. They did a good job of trying to discredit those that were up there, or at least say discredit the testimony, saying that it's just hearsay, that there's nothing substantial there, that it's just part of the so-called witch hunt. For the Democrats, I think they're going to have to try to push for more direct linking of evidence that demonstrates a profound abuse of power, which seems to be where they're going, is that they're going to try to draw up articles of impeachment on abuse of power. So far, that is just circumstantial evidence. So they need to give, you know, the so-called smoking gun that, no, there is an actual connection to an abuse of power, and they need to show that, and they need to show it strongly.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Militants continued to fire rockets into Israel Thursday after a ceasefire started as part of an effort to stall the latest bout of fighting that has killed 34 Palestinians over the past 2 days. Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem has the details.
Overnight, before the ceasefire was announced, Israel carried out an airstrike in Gaza, killing a senior member of Islamic Jihad and 7 members of his family. Residents like Abdul Hai Misra voiced anger, saying there was no warning. Misra said the house that came under attack was a peaceful house and that children were inside. Israel said it targeted a senior Islamic Jihad leader. The ceasefire followed 2 days of heavy fighting between Israel and Islamic Jihad. The fighting began after Israel assassinated a senior Islamic Jihad official Tuesday, and Islamic Jihad responded with heavy rocket attacks on central and southern Israel. More than 450 rockets were fired over the two-day period. There were several injuries and some property damage. Hamas, which controls Gaza and its 2 million people, stayed out of the fray. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin welcomed the ceasefire but issued a warning. Rivlin said Israel will not stand by while the security of its civilians is at stake. At the same time, he said Israel does not want to see an escalation. Despite the ceasefire, at least 5 projectiles were fired at southern Israel after the truce came into effect. Analysts said this incident was an attempt to show that Islamic Jihad still had rockets and wanted to have the last word. This week's fighting came amid disarray in Israeli politics. After 2 elections, neither of the leaders of Israel's 2 largest parties has been able to form a governing coalition. Israeli analysts said the fighting in Gaza could make it more likely for them to join forces. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers spotted a star traveling at an incredibly fast 6 million kilometers per hour, or 10 times faster than most stars. According to the astronomers, the star called S5HVS1 once had a companion as part of a binary system. But the 2 stars wandered too close to Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. About 5 million years ago, the intense gravity of the giant black hole swallowed the companion star but flung S5HVS1 outwards on an ultra-fast journey. The star was discovered with the Anglo-Australian Telescope, and the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite helped the astronomers gauge its speed and trace its trajectory back to the center of the Milky Way. At its current speed, the star is expected to exit the galaxy in about 100 million years from now, never to return. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Anti-government protesters paralyzed parts of Hong Kong for a 4th day on Thursday, forcing schools to close and blocking highways and other transport to disrupt the financial hub amid a marked escalation of violence. Local residents and foreigners in Hong Kong say their lives are being disrupted by the nearly 6-month-long of protests. Kai Rilo Tupchi, a businessman in a Chinese-ruled city, said that the protests have lingered on, and his concerns have grown.
Personally, I worry about the situation of Hong Kongers and China, of course. But if I have to be selfish and thinking about my own security, no, I definitely do not feel insecure in Hong Kong, no.
Resident Frankie Tang described how his life has been affected by the protests.
The last few months, my work, or social life are both affected. limited my, like, I couldn't, like, go out to have a gathering or even for work. I have to rearrange some meeting appointments.
Protesters have torched vehicles and buildings, hurled gasoline bombs at police stations and trains, and vandalized prime shopping malls over the past week in some of the worst violence seen. Black-clad protesters and university students maintain their blockades of major roads, including the entrance to the Cross Harbor Tunnel that links Hong Kong Island to the Kowloon area and a highway between Kowloon and the rural New Territories. Tang says he doesn't think the disruptions will end anytime soon.
The protesters are teenagers, and they believe they are fighting for something, and I personally think this is my last for a longer time.
The Hong Kong Education Bureau says all schools in the city will suspend classes from Friday to Sunday. Earlier, there was a report that Hong Kong would be under curfew, but police spokesman John Se Chung Chung says his department has not been asked to enforce one this weekend.
The authority to direct the curfew order rests with the CE, and that's why I think police are not in a position to comment. The force are certainly capable and determined to control the Hong Kong's social unrest at the moment.
Police also say a man dressed in black, aged in his 30s, has died. An initial investigation showed he fell from a height, and there was no suspicious circumstances. It's not clear if his death was related to the protests. Britain's Brexit Party has rejected an electoral pact with the ruling Conservatives, saying it will field 300 candidates in next month's election to force Prime Minister Boris Johnson to deliver on promises of a clean break with the European Union. Brexit Party leader Nigel Farage said Thursday the party had to contest the seats to keep pressure on Johnson, rebuffing Conservative arguments that doing so risks splitting the pro-Brexit vote and helping parties that want to remain in the EU. His comments came on the final day for candidates to register for the December 12th election. Police and medical sources told Reuters News that Iraqi security forces killed at least 4 people Thursday and wounded more than 50 as they tried to push protesters back further to their main camp in central Baghdad. They said 3 protesters died after tear gas canisters struck them in the head, and another died from wounds from a stun bomb fired by security forces. A Reuters cameraman saw security forces use live rounds, rubber bullets, and fire tear gas canisters to disperse hundreds of protesters near Tahrir Square. The sources said at least half of the wounded protesters had injuries sustained from live ammunition. Major roads around Lebanon have been reopened after a 2-day closure triggered by a TV interview with President Michel Aoun, in which he called for protesters to go home. The roads linking Beirut with the country's south and north were opened shortly before noon Thursday, as well as others around the country. Protesters have been holding demonstrations since October 17th, demanding an end to widespread corruption and mismanagement by the political class that has ruled the country for 3 decades. The UN Refugee Agency and migration agencies are appealing for $1.35 billion to provide essential humanitarian aid to millions of Venezuelan refugees and migrants who fled their country to host communities. Lisa Schlein has that story.
About 4.6 million refugees and migrants have fled Venezuela and are scattered around the world. About 80% are taking refuge in 17 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. The UN agencies say the $1.35 billion response plan aims to help all Venezuelans fleeing for their safety in the region and the communities hosting them. UN refugee spokesman Baba Balash tells VOA it is critically important for international donors to support this appeal, as there is no resolution in sight for this crisis.
So many Venezuelans are still on the run. So we're talking about refugees and migrants. And let's not forget the situation inside Venezuela is serious, and it's worsening day by day. We're talking about political and human rights issues. There's a socio-economic crisis as well.
Balash says Venezuelans arriving in Colombia, Peru, Chile, and other countries in the region are in desperate straits and in need of protection and assistance. He says says the enormity of the problem is putting huge strains upon the host communities, many of whom are impoverished. He warns the situation is likely to get worse.
We now stand at 4.6 million people being affected, refugees and migrants. And if there's no resolution, as currently there's no resolution in sight for this crisis, this figure could reach somewhere near 6.5 million by the end of 2020.
With little prospect of Venezuelans returning home in sight, the UN agencies say refugees and migrants will need to be included in the social and economic activities of local communities. The appeal will focus on providing them with health, education, food, protection, nutrition, shelter, and other essential relief and care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan met at the White House Wednesday but did not resolve major irritants in the country's relationship, including Turkey's recent incursion into northern Syria and its purchase of Russian military hardware. White House correspondent Patsy Widakuswara has more.
A warm reception for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan from President Donald Trump at a time when U.S.-Turkey relations are at its coldest.
We've been friends for a long time, almost from day one.
The two countries said they wanted to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion, more than three times its current state.
Our economic relationship has tremendous potential and continues to expand and to grow. Direct engagement and diplomacy between our nations are essential to ensuring a future of peace and prosperity and promise for our citizens.
The visit came as Ankara faced congressional backlash over its incursion into northern Syria and attacks on Kurdish forces in October, for which a permanent ceasefire is still unclear. The Kurds are American allies in the fight against Islamic State. Erdogan dismissed questioning about why he ignored Trump's request not to invade northern Syria and continued to call Kurdish forces terrorists.
Kürtlerle bir sorunumuz yok.
First, we have to make a distinction between two things. We have no problems with the Kurds. We have problems with terrorist organizations, some of which are coming out of the Kurds.
Turkey's offensive marked further worsening in bilateral relations with Washington. Bülent Alireza is the director of the Turkey Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
They've got appreciably worse, as evidenced by the lopsided votes in the House of Representatives, both on the Armenian Genocide Resolution as well as on the Engel-McCall resolution, which actually includes sanctions against Turkey for its intervention in northern Syria. But all this is happening at a time when the relationship between the two leaders is as close as it's been.
On security issues, Turkey, a NATO ally, is turning to Russia, including its recent purchase of the S-400 missile defense system. In retaliation, the administration banned the sale of American F-35 jets to Ankara. Neither leader provided details on the resolution of this issue Wednesday, but prior to the visit, Turkey had threatened to buy more Russian jets, particularly if Congress blocks further sale of American military hardware. Max Hoffman is the associate director at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions.
Erdogan will feel betrayed again, and he may turn back to Putin and say, well, you're a guy I can do business with. You don't have a pesky legislature to deal with. You're an absolute ruler, and I kind of like dealing with those kinds of guys.
Analysts say that future U.S.-Turkey relations will have to rely on more than the chemistry of its leaders. Erdogan's visit came on the first day of public impeachment inquiry hearings, and as demonstrations were held in front of the White House protesting Turkey's offensive on the Kurds at the Syrian border. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, White House.
An American suspected of being a member of the Islamic State group may be returning to his country from Turkey. AP's Ben Thomas has that update. Apparently we do not have the audio. And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our production staff, producer Nadia Taha, engineer Patrick Dalle, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.